Hi, you're listening to The Professionals Playbook, a podcast that brings transparency to top performers, careers, and topics. My name is Justin Hazard Lee. I'm an F-35 fighter pilot for the Air Force. One of the most important lessons I've learned is that you have to be selective with who you listen to. There's a lot of noise out there. The goal of this podcast is to find experts who are at the top of their field to share their insights based on credibility and experience. My guest today is Drew Kataoka, who's built the top art studio in Silicon Valley and did it entirely outside the gallery system. Her studio serves top art collectors in four continents and over 30 countries. Her art was used for the first zero-gravity art exhibit in space at the International Space Station. She was also selected as a World Economic Forum Young Global Leader and Cultural Leader. Today's episode is brought to you by Bremont, over-engineered watches for professionals. In the last few years, Bremont has taken over as the fighter pilot's watch. Their combination of precision, quality, and customer service is unmatched. You can see all of their watches by going to Bremont.com. Now here's a highlight from the conversation today.
This was an artwork called Up. It was art for the first zero gravity art exhibit in space at the International Space Station. And it was for Richard Garriott's mission to the International Space Station. And we were given instructions, you know, you can't create anything that's this size, you can't use this material, you can't do this. This huge list of things that you cannot do, because to get something on payload for a space launch, there's all of these restrictions. And so I was thinking about how space exploration is about breaking boundaries and breaking through restrictions. So I actually created a piece that was bigger than what they said that we were allowed to take on board.
In our conversation, we talk about how art can be a catalyst for creativity in other professions, how creativity is like a muscle that you have to train, and the future of art in virtual and augmented reality. If you're enjoying the show and want to keep up with me, you can follow along on Instagram or LinkedIn at Justin Fighter Pilot. I also send out a monthly newsletter. You can find that by going to professionalsplaybook.com. Now, without further ado, Drew Kataoka. All right, Drew, welcome to the show. Thank you for coming on.
It's a great pleasure to be here with you, Justin.
So when I think back to my experience with art, usually it goes back to third grade, making terrible ashtrays for my parents. They didn't even smoke, so there's really no use for them. But it seemed back then, at least, that art was on one side, science was on the other side. And knowing I wanted to be a pilot, I gravitated towards the science side. But having had a chance to fly fighters for a while, the best pilots seem to be more creative in terms of mission planning. They're more creative in terms of solving tactical decisions airborne. Do you think art fosters creativity?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that art is one of humanity's greatest gifts, and it just opens your mind up to so many possibilities. It really asks you questions. And I think great art keeps asking you questions and keeps engaging you on these really deep levels. It really kicks your brain open like a door to new things. And I think when you get in touch with a great artwork, whether you're immersed in front of a Leonardo da Vinci or a Michelangelo, you're in touch with something almost cosmic, because you're syncing up with the brainwaves and the ideas of these geniuses, and they're communicating with you over hundreds of years or over thousands of years. And so I think it's essential for young people, for old people, for people of all age to create surface area for themselves with art. I mean, art is just amazing, hyper boost of creativity, and we really need that in the world that we live in today. You know, I think that one of the great misperceptions, which is conveniently fostered by a good part of the contemporary art world, is that art is just emotional and intuitive and almost just boils down to being this purely cathartic thing. You know, you feel it with your heart. But in actuality, great art is deeply cerebral. And in fact, in some cases, more cerebral than emotional. And it makes you think about some really deep philosophical questions that are very important, especially now for us as we enter this kind of fourth industrial revolution, virtual reality, augmented reality, artificial intelligence enveloped world that's very globalized world. You know, all of these big questions that we have that are looming out there. You know, what does it mean to be human? What is our place in the universe? Why do we treat others the way that we do? What's the purpose of society? So it really plays a very significant role. And I think it's interesting to hear you talk about the role of creativity in pilots and in the work that you're doing.
Yeah, one of the things I saw on your website that I really resonated with was art is a double shot of espresso for creativity. And I never thought of it like that. But I think in every career field, what separates the good from the best is the ability to be creative. And I think a lot more people would probably be open to art a little bit more if they realize that it could help them out in their current role.
Yeah, and I think that there's an element of creativity. I like to think about it as sometimes as creative fitness. So there's a kind of myth about it. There's a myth about creativity that there's this apple that hits you on the head, or there's this bolt of lightning that comes out of the sky, and this is perpetuated by a lot of things that we see, I think, in Hollywood. But in actuality, you experience creative epiphanies when you put yourself in the way of creativity. That is to say, when you are exposing yourself to great ideas, challenging yourself with kind of creative calisthenics, if you will. It's the same thing as physical fitness. You know, if Michael Jordan sits on the couch all day long, even though he's so talented, he just eats potato chips. He's never going to be able to make those incredible shots that he does. And I think that a lot of practice and preparation is what enables you to access the creative freedom that you want to be able to kind of reach scale the creative heights that you want to be able to scale. I mean, I think it's interesting you talk about the HOTAS and the piccolo drill and all of those different finger movements and getting the muscle memory under your fingers. And I thought it was interesting when you were talking about that, because there's this reference to it being like a musical instrument. And similarly, you drill and you drill and you drill, you learn all these different kinds of finger positions so that they're natural and they're intuitive, so that in the moment, you can actually be in the position to improvise. Because what is going to happen in real life, in a real unfolding piece of jazz music or in combat or perhaps in a large-scale artwork that takes a different type of turn that you didn't expect, is that, you know, ultimately, you're going to have to improvise. And it's all that preparation that's going to lead you to that moment where you can have the ultimate creative freedom.
Absolutely. The ability to improvise is critical as a pilot. But I do think that my experience isn't unique in that a lot of people think art is way off on one side, science is off on the other side. Has that been your experience? And why do you think that is?
You're talking about this division between art and science and the humanities and technology, which is important to look at and is troubling, because we live in a great time. I mean, more people than ever have access to education than ever before. But one of the unfortunate things about our time, Justin, is that it's an era of hyper-specialization, of siloing and kind of incrementality and incremental thinking. And one of the reasons that there was a concentration of so many extraordinary breakthroughs during the Renaissance was because there was so much surface area between very different disciplines, and not just within geographical regions, but actually residing in the actual people themselves. And so, you know, the embodiment of this was people like Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo Buonarroti. And one example is that I think it's fascinating that both of them extensively performed dissections on human bodies. You know, the reason why the flesh of the thighs and of the torsos on the Sistine Chapel that Michelangelo painted are so realistic was because at night he was like pulling apart sinews of legs and skeletons, and he thinking, I really need to understand this. And similarly, you know, with Leonardo, the reason why the Vitruvian man is so well proportioned is because he was taking apart brain stems and fetuses and just taking apart these bodies in an effort to really truly understand. And so what was happening was that, yes, these were artists, but they were engineers and they were scientists at the same time. And they were actually at the cutting edge of the biological sciences. And in the case of Leonardo, he was making breakthroughs in optics and in physics that were so far ahead of their time that those breakthroughs had to be made again several hundreds of years later, because he never published the majority of what he figured out. So he figured out all these extraordinary things and then he didn't publish them. And then it took the rest of humanity several hundred years in many respects for some of these things to catch up and figure them out. So I think that when we look to those guys, they are tremendous inspiration, and we can unlock so much if we look at how they saw the world, how they connected things, how they made these leaps. And those are the things that can, when we cross-sect different fields, those are the things that can lead to step function leaps and to breakthroughs.
It seems like even modern day scientists, a lot of them have gravitated towards the arts. Richard Feynman was famous for his drums. And then also, I think he was an artist in terms of drawing things. Einstein played the violin. So I don't think it's just modern scientists as well kind of gravitate towards the arts, some of the best ones.
Absolutely. Feynman loved to play the bongo drums, and he also took up drawing at a very late age, like in his 40s, I believe. And I think that's pretty inspirational and empowering. You know, here's one of the greatest physicists ever advising NASA, advising presidents, and he decides he's gonna make himself vulnerable and take up drawing. And he talks about going into his first drawing class, and there's a nude woman in the center of the class, and everyone's just outdoing him with their drawing. And he didn't know what he was doing, but he quickly learned and he built a whole body of work. And then he ended up creating this body of paintings, which are uniquely through his lens of the world, which is really beautiful and powerful. And I think the lesson there is that there's always going to be fields that you don't know anything about and you feel uncomfortable in, but you should try and you should reach out and you should explore those different things. And then on the other side, when we have people that come into our fields that are new, we need to be welcoming and help create those bridges and create those dialogues between different disciplines, and don't be so tribal and say, this, you know, this is our group and that's your group and you just stay over there. You want to have that cross-fertilization of ideas and help foster that. And it's true that Einstein loved the violin. He played from a young age, and he said that if he were not a physicist, he would be a musician, that he thought, or he liked to think about ideas in terms of music. And his son said that he would play when he was stuck with a certain idea that he couldn't figure out, and he would go into the kitchen and play and play and play, and then finally shout Eureka. And so there was a way in which playing music helped his brain process difficult problems. And similarly with Feynman, I think this drawing that he did, it wasn't just a hobby or something cool or neat or fun. It helped him develop some of his most groundbreaking ideas in physics. He had these things called the Feynman diagrams, and he created this way of visually explaining some very difficult concepts. And that was all related to the art that he created, and, you know, ultimately some of those really large breakthroughs.
And technology seems to be the same way. You might have a great perspective on this living in Silicon Valley, but I think back to the early 2000s, and there's really, in my opinion, only one tech company that was making products that looked great, and that was Apple. They had the iPod, which looked great. The Zoom, not so much. They had the MacBook Pro. That was the aluminum casing that looked great. Everybody else was just making, you know, boxes. And even in the last few years, electric cars looked terrible until Tesla came around. And that's really one of the reasons that jump-started the EV kind of revolution that's going on. So why do you think we keep learning this lesson over and over again, that people want to see products that look great as well?
I think it's amazing that there's this conversation all the time around STEM and how we need to get girls in STEM and boys in STEM and invest in STEM education, when in actuality, what we really need to invest in is STEAM, that is to say science, technology, engineering, but also arts and design and mathematics and the way those different things intersect if we really want to create great things in civilization. If you look at all of the high watermarks of civilization, our greatest achievements, those things are not purely mathematical. They're not purely visual or purely artistic, or they're really like a seamless blending of artistry, mathematics, sometimes physics, sometimes spirituality. Look at something like the Parthenon in ancient Greece, which is this incredible architectural marble, which is an artistic masterpiece, but it had incredible mathematical breakthroughs and feats of engineering. It was also a spiritual temple, but where one thing begins and the other ends, you really cannot take apart. And I think if you look at, you mentioned Apple, the thing that preceded the iPod and the iPhone was the MP3 player. And the MP3 player, I say that's an example of STEM technology. It worked. It was definitely a big improvement from technologically from, let's say, the CD player and other things that came before it, but nobody really wanted to use it. It was awkward. It didn't integrate in people's lives. And I say that the iPod and then the iPhone and all those devices are examples of STEAM technology. The artistry, the design is seamless with the engineering and the hardware and the software, and it all comes together so that it's so beautiful that it's something that you want to have with you integrated into your life at all times, and it just seamlessly becomes a part of your day-to-day experience. And Steve Jobs says that the early Macintosh team, one of the things that was really critical about it was that they had computer scientists that were musicians, they had zoologists, they had historians, they had writers, they had mathematicians, and they had computer scientists that were also, you know, had these different backgrounds. So it was a very diverse group of people. I say that it was a dream STEAM team, if you will. And that was the kind of group of people that led to creating those products. And then when he later went to Pixar, he was very thoughtful about the way that the whole layout of the building was constructed. So he designed that with the thought in mind that he didn't want to keep engineering over here and the design people over here and the graphics people over here and even the business people over here. He created this atrium where people would have to cross each other in the hallway and interact with each other. And it worked really well. And the people who worked there spoke about how they would interact with people who weren't from their, you know, heads down day-to-day group. And that sparked a lot of innovation as well. So I think there's a lot of things that all of us can do in our day-to-day lives to take these principles in.
Right. Facilitating those connections is so important. I was just, as I was telling you, I was gone the last couple of weeks training with some other types of aircraft because building those connections is so important. So over the course of your career, have you focused on kind of merging this science and art, or where did your artistic journey start and how has that kind of evolved over the years?
Today, I'm running the top art studio in Silicon Valley, and I've built it entirely outside the gallery system, which is the conventional route, but also not unlike Hollywood and the music industry is very exploitative of young artists. And as a result, I mean, I chose not to go to an art school because I think that they are really stuck in the old ways. And frankly, they don't prepare you for the new technologies, for the new world that we live in, you know, how to code, essential STEM skills. And the talent caliber compared to top educational institutions is really not at the same level. So I chose to go to Stanford. And when I was there, I designed my own curriculum. I decided that, yeah, I'm going to take art, but I'm going to take multivariable calculus. I'm going to take computer science. I'm going to take classics. And I'm going to take other STEM classes. I'm going to take psychology. But I'm going to create my own interdisciplinary curriculum. And the university is very embracing of that. And I'm really glad that I took that path because I feel that it's what's prepared me for where I am today. But it was also inspirational because at that time, my classmates, they were building companies like Google and PayPal. And there was this whole startup fever that was in the air. And there was kind of also kind of a reality distortion field around the campus. There was this sense of possibility everywhere. And so I said, you know, let's build an art business like a startup, you know, lean, agile, disruptive, iterative. And I knew that it would be harder, but I knew at the end of the day that it would pay off in so many ways. And that's been definitely the case. So today we are serving top art collectors in over 30 countries on 4 continents. And the majority of work that we do is privately commissioned. We're blessed to have a roster of some of the top visionaries and venture capitalists and entrepreneurs and business leaders as our clients.
Yeah. Can you talk to how you started that business? Because I'm sure there are a lot of artists out there that are great at art, but it seems difficult and it's a jump to build a business around that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think the first thing is just breaking away from the myth that we have or the archetype that we have in our mind as an artist, as not being a business person. You know, I think, again, this goes back to some of the ways that artists are taught in art schools today. They are not given the business skills that they need. But in today's world, and I think you probably feel the same way, Justin, it's a world where you have to always be learning all the time. And you have to figure it out what it is you need to do to acquire whatever skills that you feel are relevant. And I think that idea of always being in a learning mode is something that's so important. I think it's something that Bill Gates subscribes to, Jeff Bezos, I'm sure you subscribe to that idea. So that's one thing. Always be in a learning mode. And then in terms of your business, I would tell artists to be more entrepreneurial and less just hands off and laid back about how things are going to unfold for them with this idea that, you know, all they need to do is just create. But because what they actually need to do is really think about the larger picture, how they fit into society, what kind of legacy they want to leave, what their plan is, what their business plan is, like to create a business plan for their business, kind of to go over all those considerations. I think that the current gallery system is very difficult for artists. It really ties their hands. The economics and the balance of power and the relationship is very bad. There are various middlemen. There's various consultants. And the main thing is that a gallery will take 50% of a sale, which is the largest of any industry. And on top of that, the artist has to assume the risk and the artist has to put in the upfront investment for the work. And so when you get to the point of doing a whole show where you have 30 works, you're putting in tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars and you have no guarantee of return and you're assuming all this risk. So I think that artists tie themselves down in that system. And I think that they have to think about really what the trade-offs are. And sometimes And I think maybe you probably have experienced this yourself too. You have to do the harder things first in order for them to get easier. If you take the easy path at the beginning, then you're kind of stuck, and you're tied down in a system that you don't have control over.
So you work on a commission model where somebody, a customer, reaches out to you and gives input on kind of what they want, and then you design an art piece around that. Is that how it typically works?
So the majority of the works that we do are privately commissioned, and it's a fantastic model. It's actually the rebirth of a model that was the predominant model during the Renaissance, and actually for the majority of all of art history. So we think about the gallery model as being something that's been around forever, but it's actually a super short time blip on the overall long arc of art history. It's really only 100 years old. It was something that was developed and perfected in the United States and based off of the retail boutique, inspired by the retail boutique. And as such, it bears all these characteristics with retail. And the idea of the commission is something that was, the commission model, commission patron model, was something that was much older, has been a part of art history for much longer, and is the model that has produced the greatest instances of immortal artworks, what I call immortal artworks, those works that have really endured and stood the test of time and had some enduring value. So today we are seeing actually a rebirth of that model in Silicon Valley. That's what we do in Drew Kotalka Studios. And it's great because we get to work with really fantastic patrons. And I'd say that we are working with us is akin to almost more like an architectural firm. We're very consultative. We're very customer centric. We are thinking about problem solving along with the client. Like, what do they want to do? What are they trying to accomplish? Where is this piece going to go? Is it in a home or is it in an organization? And what kind of values and ideas should we try to embed in it? What do we want to capture? And then we architect the concept. We propose some ideas, and we can preview those for the client in virtual reality, in augmented reality. We can allow them to even walk through a geometric model of something before it's complete. We can on the fly change the scale of something as you're in deciding how you might want to fabricate that piece, which is pretty cool that we can use that kind of technology for those purposes now. And then we execute it and we fabricate it to the highest level. And because it's a commission model, the unit economics are so much better. We can give a better price ultimately to the consumer. We can lavish more on materials, on the time that we put in a piece, because ultimately when something's commissioned, it's financed upfront. So, and typically we take 50% upfront and then we take 50% upon completion. But when you are creating things within a retail model, you know, you're creating a bunch of things which you don't know if they're going to sell, and you have to figure out who they're going to match up to and with what patron. And so you're out on a limb with a lot of economic risk, and a lot of artists go in debt that way.
And what kind of art have you guys been specializing in recently?
So today we are focusing on three types of works. The first ones are sculptures in mirror polished stainless steel. So we've been very innovative in this domain in creating a whole language, a whole grammar, a whole vocabulary around reflective fragments that comes out of my previous work with mirrors and mirror fragments and experimentation with using the laws of physics in different ways to create all sorts of different shapes and patterns. But in steel, we are using the highest grade of steel, and we are bringing it up to a mirror polish finish, which is a 4 or 5 stage process of moving from a higher grit to a finer and finer, finer grit. It's a very, very demanding process that results in something that's extraordinarily beautiful. The finished products look like big polished jewels with some of these sculptures at 9 or 10 feet tall. And what happens is, because they're reflective, the different fragments take the environment And then there's also spaces in the work. So you get a blend of different pieces of the environment around you, different pieces of yourself and the people around you and what's in front of you. And all those things are getting blended and mixed together. So it's cognitively very stimulating, and it's easier when you see it. You know, if you go to drue.net, D-R-U-E.net, you can actually see some videos of what this actually looks like. But then the second type of works that we're doing are called ambrosias. And the ambrosias are these multidimensional sculptures that are reflective, that are multiplanar, that are also the first fully modular works that we've created, so that there's actually millions of physical permutations in which you could change the arrangement of the pieces inside. So I like the idea that that gives the collector a sense of agency, and that they can change the dominance of color, because the different pieces have different colors inside on the edges and on the backs that gets embedded in them. And the structure is so complex that it's hard to really understand when you're looking at a piece of a certain reflection. Where is it coming from? How was it generated? So it's kind of delightfully disorienting, if you will, and kind of cognitively stimulating and beautiful. And it's just the whole experience. It just heightens and stimulates your creativity. So I think that's one of the hallmarks of what we do, is creating these pieces that when you're around them, they stimulate your creativity. They change your lens on the world. They change your perspective, literally and physically, on your surroundings. And then the third area of work is technological artworks. We've always been a pioneer of this intersection of art and technology. And over the years, we've done works with EEG, with brainwaves, with mobile platforms. We created artwork for the first zero gravity art exhibit in space at the International Space Station. And that was the first artwork to have embedded relativistic effects in it. And I can tell you about that if you want to know about it. It's the only artwork of mine that has flown, Justin, like you.
That's incredible. Can you talk to how that started? Because I know that was, first art exhibit for the International Space Station. That's incredible.
So this was an artwork called Up. It was art for the first zero gravity art exhibit in space at the International Space Station. And it was for Richard Garriott's mission to the International Space Station. And we were given instructions, you know, you can't create anything that's this size. You can't use this material. You can't do this. This huge list of things that you cannot do, because to get something on payload for a space launch, there's all of these restrictions. And so I was thinking about how space exploration is about breaking boundaries and breaking through restrictions. So I actually created a piece that was bigger than what they said that we were allowed to take on board. But what I did was I told Richard, and he was the person that was flying. I said, Richard, I'm going to surrender this next stage of the process to you. I'm going to ask you what part of the painting you would like to cut out with you and take into space. So there was this kind of collaborative effort, which is at the heart of space exploration and space missions as well. So he chose that piece, and that piece went into space. That was the celestial piece. The rest of the work remained on Earth, and that was the earthbound terrestrial piece. I call that the mission control of the art. And it was the first time in the history of art that one work of art had been separated from itself at such speeds and distances. And because that piece traveled at those speeds, because of the effects as described by Einstein in his special theory of relativity, the piece that went to space and then came back is now slightly younger than the one that never left the ground. So there's one, and we have them framed so that one is hovering over the other piece. So there's a younger piece and an older piece. And they're two different ages in one work of art. But it wasn't just an abstract idea. It was really to serve an overall idea of the work, which was this work of art was to be a conceptual portrait of father and son. In other words, Richard's father was an astronaut. He had flown on Skylab. And when he was a little boy, he looked up to his dad and said, I want to be an astronaut one day. And so he eventually did. He became a private citizen flying in space. And so this idea of a smaller piece that gets taken from a larger whole, leaves, departs, goes on an odyssey and returns is really the human experience. Like, we're kind of ripped from our parents' bodies. We leave, we go on our journeys, we come back, and we're the same, but we're not the same. We're in the same place, but we're not in the same place. And that's what space exploration is about as well, sending our best sons and daughters into the cosmos.
So what's the process like, for instance, when he came to you and said, I want to make some art? How do you work with him to develop what you actually sent up there?
Well, that particular product was veiled in so much secrecy and so many legal documents because it was like the secret space mission, and it felt quite surreal and Kafkaesque. But I was given all of the parameters, and then I proposed what I wanted to do, and they loved it. And so then we just executed it and worked together to make it happen. And in general, for all the commissioned work we do, I think somehow people have a concern or a misperception about commissioned art that somehow the artist has less freedom. But in my mind, I think it's a model where the artist has more freedom. You have more capital, more time, more levers to play with. And you have a patron who is working with you, who is like a partner to you, who wants to help co-birth some very meaningful piece and instantiate it into the world and bring it into the world. And so it's quite amazing. And then they come to you. When we have people that come to us, and we have people that we've worked with many, many times, we have a lot of repeat customers, if you will. Then we have new people that we've never worked with, but they've seen another one of our pieces in another home or location. They might have an idea of something that they want to capture. They generally know what place that they want to put something, but sometimes they're not sure. And we talk that through with all of those details, but people are not too prescriptive. I mean, they don't come and say, we want this and this and this and this and this and this and with a full definition. Because at that point, if you have all those definitions, you can go out and execute it yourself, right? Mm-hmm. They generally come with some kind of very high level forms of inspiration and some kind of very interesting problems that really intrigue my mind, that really spark my creativity. So bring these problems, these ideas, these questions, and then we work on it. And we propose a variety of solutions, and then ultimately we execute it. The whole process is very exciting. It's very creatively stimulating, and it's the thing that keeps allowing me to push me and my team to new places. We like to take on hard things. We like to do difficult things. We like to try to work with materials that we haven't worked with before. We don't like to just kind of crank out spot painting, drip painting, drip painting. We like to do hard things that make us grow and that make us learn.
What kind of questions or things do you use to draw out some of the things that the customer wants? Because I'm sure, as you said, they don't come to you with everything they want. So do you have to draw, I guess, things from them to help inspire the art?
Yeah, I think that's true. There's a lot of questions and dialogue and conversation and listening and taking notes. And in some cases, with the permission of the client, recording of the conversations so that it can go back and think. And so in some cases where there's pieces that are very personal, I would be asking questions about family history or what it is that really makes that person tick and how they think about the world, and even trying to understand what their favorite books are or music, along with a whole set of practical questions as well. But it really depends from project to project, I would say. And then completing the answer to this question about what we create, this third category of works that we create under this technological category. I spoke about the piece that was in space, but then we have also done a lot of work in virtual reality and have been very interested in that space. I've been watching it from the time of 2007, because I was very close to the people at the Virtual Human Interaction Lab at Stanford University, who had and have today one of the top labs in the country. And then several years ago, we got our own rigs and have been building and creating here in VR.
Yeah, VR, that's something as a pilot, as a fighter pilot, I can really appreciate, because when we go and fly, we have an augmented reality helmet. And so it puts symbols over the various aircraft and other things out there that tremendously add and aid to our situational awareness. So I can definitely see that as the future once they can make it less than 5 pounds. I'm sure Apple's working on some glasses where, you know, you can just put that on and seamlessly see the world. So how do you see augmented reality, virtual reality, art going into the future?
Yeah, I think it's fascinating to talk about VR and AR with you, Justin. You talk about chair flying and, you know, VR and AR, VR especially is great for, like, you know, running scenarios and simulating things and visualizing things and getting prepared and figuring out how to improvise in, you know, different states of uncertainty when you're hit with like a million possibilities. And similarly in art, it's an amazing way to stage all sorts of different possibilities and help not only just create new things, but help stretch your mind in new directions. I think one of the things that I have on my wall in the studio is, what can we do in virtual reality? What can we build in VR that it's not in the real world? And I think the tendency is for us to drag and drop our reality into virtual reality. So here's a table and chairs and a couch, and then let's go put a couch and a table and chairs in VR. And it's like, there's so many things, so much baggage that we have that we carry over. And so there's an incredible creative exercise that you can go through, which is just cutting those tethers to reality, if you will, so that you can end up building and creating a whole new things, which is going to be amazing for scientists and physicists as well. Because when previously they had ideas that they wanted to explore, it would be very abstract. And now they can build whole simulations with new worlds that contain new laws that they are speculating about. And then they could go live in that world for a week. And that, I think that would totally transform how they were thinking about, you know, what they are doing. I believe that virtual reality, I mean, I say to people, oh, it's not really a technology. It's really just an art form, if you will, because it's the realization of a dream, really, that artists have had since the beginning of time. That is to transport the viewer or to transport other people and immerse them in something. So when you go back to the cave paintings in Lascaux, you have an artist trying to say, this was the hunt, this was the bison hunt, and I want you to feel as if you were there. And the technology that they had at the time was wall and chalk, and they pushed it to its limits. And then you go to the Renaissance and you have the Sistine Chapel ceiling and the creation of man, and this effort to immerse us in that whole experience as if we were there that Michelangelo is creating. And today, atom by atom, pixel by pixel, we actually can build these whole immersive worlds. And they are quite demanding to build, because before, if you're creating a painting, you only have to think and consider one point of view. But when we are building these artworks in virtual reality, you have to consider everything around you, up, down, from every angle. You know that the viewer has agency to move around. And I like to give them the agency to teleport and to move through the work. So they're going to be seeing things from all different points of view. It's a lot of detail to create. It's a lot of visual decisions to make, but it's also very exciting. And as far as the future goes, I think that, you know, we are going to be spending the majority of our time in these virtual reality, augmented reality, artificial intelligence powered worlds, and it's going to happen much faster than we think. And so I think that's another reason why it's important to create the next generation of young people that are hybrid trained, hybrid thinkers, that are both well-versed in computer science, but art, engineering, and the humanities, aesthetics, psychology, the humanities, so that they build worlds that are going to really help us become our best selves. Because I think we're going to be spending so much time in these worlds that our creativity will depend on it, and maybe even our sanity.
How do you build one of these worlds? What does that look like?
One of the things that I've been passionate about is building different sculptures, building different shapes, or in digital tool terminology, assets, if you will, directly in VR. This is a new field. This is a new area. So if you look at even in the entertainment industry, a place like, you know, Industrial Light and Magic, and I know many of the amazing people there, the majority of like Hollywood studios and entertainment studios, when they're building three-dimensional assets, they're actually still doing it on like Wacom tablets on flat surfaces. So they'll use a pen and they'll spin the little Yoda around and they'll sculpt it. And it's great what they're doing. But what you can do now is you can actually get into VR and shape an object with your own bare hand. It's a much more visceral, immediate way of working and creating that's more akin to how sculptors originally created, except there is no haptic feedback for it at this point. And that is going to be the modality of creation of the future. So in however many years' time, we're going to get more and more away from just the two-dimensional way of working, and we're going to be more immersed into a spatialized way of creating. So that's the future. Today, it's so new, right? So it's rocky, it's buggy, there's problems with it, but it's so exciting and it's so amazing. And there's a various applications out there, and every single thing that is possible to use as it's come out, I've been a very early adopter and advocate of. And there's a lot of different tools. Tilt Brush is one of the most famous ones, and I have been an artist in residence for the virtual reality Tilt Brush team at Google. But there's tools like Oculus Medium that are great, and Masterpiece, and Gravity Sketch. I also know the founders of Gravity Sketch. That's a great tool, and many, many more. And then what I do is I take all those things and I bring those things into a gaming engine, and I write the code to govern the behaviors of all of these different objects, how the lighting will behave and fall, and how, what kind of interactions a person would have if they touch an object. You know, there's one world where I have, where if you touch these blue spheres, they turn into kind of this crystalline water, and there's a sound that it's falling on you. And so, you know, it's amazing. You touch the different things and all these different things happen. So I like that when you walk through these worlds, they're never going to be the same twice.
It's incredible the technical training that you have to do in terms of the mirror polish, stainless steel, the VR, having to go out and learn these hard skills to be able to incorporate in your art. Do you have any, I guess, techniques for going out and learning something new, learning a new technique for your art?
I think that's a great question, Justin. And I think that it really is as simple as persevering and having grit, in the sense that I think people give up too fast. All these things are hard because they're hard. And you could try and try and try, and it's difficult, and it crumbles and it falls apart, and it and the code doesn't run, and something is going wrong. And that's exactly when you just have to double down and say, well, I need to review these details again. Like, what are we not getting? Like, talk to someone, you know, explore more, figure it out, just crack it open. You know, back to Leonardo da Vinci, if you look at his notebooks, he was fascinated by puzzles and by creating different kinds of pictograms. And there was this mathematical challenge of the time, which was squaring the circle. And there were other things like this. And he has like sheets and sheets and sheets and sheets and sheets and sheets of just these little geometric things over and over and over that he did for hours and hours and weeks trying to crack these little geometrical puzzles. And it's inspiring, because I think when we think about artistic geniuses, we think, oh, they just get something, they do something, they produce something. It's like, no, they work really hard, and they were just tenacious around a problem that just took hold of their imagination, and they couldn't sleep. They couldn't let it go until they figured it out. So I think I would say to all young artists, and just all anyone who's creating or doing anything like this, just don't get discouraged. If you're getting discouraged, that's good. You're doing something hard. that means it's worth doing, and that you should, and that you should keep doing it.
Is there anything that you do day to day in terms of routine that helps you to perform at a high level?
So I get up early. I like to get up at 6. I drink a lot of liquids and tea. And I know this sounds really basic, but I feel like that has had a really direct impact on my creative energy. Like the few times that I've been really dehydrated, it hasn't been good. And I know you've talked about the impact of dehydration when you're pulling a certain amount of G's that could contribute to you blacking out, that could basically kill you in the line of work that you're doing. So I think that it's basic and yet people don't do it enough. So I think hydration is really important. I meditate, and actually meditation is part of ink painting, of the Japanese ink painting training that I started out with in the beginning part of my life. And that is that when you have a suzuri, a grinding stone, you have an ink stick, you have the water on the stone, and before you even pick up the brush to make these brush strokes, which are indelible and they can't be changed, so there's a certain amount of pressure that goes along with that. It's not like oil painting where you can paint over whatever you don't like. You spend an hour, 30 minutes to an hour, just grinding the ink, and the ink is very fragrant. It's beautiful, but it's quiet. It's a reflective time of emptying your mind. And so I think it's interesting that that is embedded in that type of artistic training, but just meditation. I think meditation is really important for everyone. And I know that you do it every day as well. Another thing for performance that is interesting, I think might be helpful to other people as well, is that I like to practice under extreme conditions. And what I mean by that is, if you have to perform like a talk where you have to remember a lot of things and deliver it, or a musical performance, like several weeks ago, I did a performance by memory of a piece at Stanford for the birthday celebration of Martin Luther King. What I like to do is practice with a lot of interruptions, the speaking or the playing of the music or whatever it is. One of the things I was inspired by at Stanford when I worked with a lot of the athletes there, because I had done a lot of paintings of athletes and sports when I was at Stanford, was the kickers, the football players, they practice with a lot of people yelling in their ear and trying to harass them and throw them off. And I love that, because if they were to just practice with everyone being nice, and then they go into the real game and the whole game is hanging on them, depending on them, thousands of people are like shouting and talking smack, then they're going to get thrown off. But if they practice that way, they're going to be doing a lot better. And I think that the same can be said for just something like doing a talk, or this can apply to all sorts of different business people, or anyone has to do any kind of presentation. You have to do a presentation, practice it while you have your family, like, talk smack at you, interrupt you, play things, play loud music in your face, and then you'll be unshakable.
Right. I mean, we have a similar thing in the fighter world. As soon as you put on your helmet, you lose 10 IQ points just because there's so much going on. Your heart's racing, that kind of stuff. And as you get more experienced, you lose less and less IQ points. But if you expect to go out and into a high pressure environment and perform better than you do in training, then you're probably going to be disappointed. So you need to have that buffer built in, so when you're in a stressful environment and you lose some of those IQ points, that you still have enough to accomplish the mission. So when you're doing a piece of art and you get stuck, what are some ways to work around that?
I think just changing your perspective, sometimes switching to another project. We always have a lot of different projects going on. And, you know, it's true that at times you can hit a really tough or intractable problem that you just, it's killing you. You're just not figuring out how to solve it. And I think at a certain point, there's diminishing returns in a given moment. So it's good to switch to maybe it's something else, a different project, or maybe something totally different, like even just something as simple as going on a walk and kind of clearing your mind and anything that will radically change your perspective, or which might seem counterintuitive because it's not directly affecting the problem. But I think that sometimes the best solutions to problems are indirect. I think that when we try to get too linear and find that direct pathway to the heart of the problem, it is when it oftentimes just doesn't want to work for us. And somehow if we can unlock, there's many different indirect pathways that lead us right to the heart of the solution, but we have to kind of stumble into those and get into those.
And I want to spend a little bit of time. I know in our previous discussions, you've talked to the importance of Japan on you and your artwork. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Well, so I was born in Tokyo, and my father is Japanese. My mother is American. My father is actually of a samurai lineage, and I have inherited the family swords. And our family can trace their genealogy with temple records in the hills of Nagoya that date back 4 centuries. And my father said the family tree is reliable back to 1600. And in that year, Japan was split into two warring camps, and each was led by a feudal warlord vying for hegemony of Japan. One was the Tokugawa and the other was the Toyotomi, and they were defeated in the Battle of Sekigahara. My ancestors fought on the Toyotomi side, and then after the battle, they settled in the village of Kataoka and in the mountains of central Japan, and they perfected the art of sake brewing. I never left the village. My dad was actually a political scientist. He was involved in the LDP, the Liberal Democratic Party, which is one of the biggest political parties in Japan. He worked with Prime Minister Nakasone and advised leading politicians, and he was one of the main proponents for Japan's military independence. And he wrote the book, The Price of a Constitution, which is an amazing book, and it still has a lot of influence years after his death. But one day he called me and he said that he was going to come to the Bay Area from Tokyo and that he would bring the family swords. So I met him at SFO Airport, and I said, "Dad, do we have to wait for the checked luggage, or what's happening?" And he said, "No, I'm ready to go." I said, "But you just only have your carry-on." He says, "Yeah." So he had brought the swords in his carry-on luggage in a post 9/11 world and just sailed right through. That's my dad. That's, you know, my mom would be stopped for a Perrier bottle by the TSA, but that was my dad. That was just how he,
TSA just how he did on. It.
Yeah. And he brought those swords, in a post 9/11 world. Now it's interesting that the swords are always supposed to be passed to a male heir. It's really important. And he was the eldest son. I'm the only child and under this line. So I have them, and they are really, really beautiful. It makes me think a lot about Miyamoto Musashi. Miyamoto Musashi was Japan's greatest swordsman. He fought 60 duels and then he died peacefully in his sleep. But he was also an artist, and he wrote this book called The Book of the Five Rings. And he spoke extensively about how the warrior should also cultivate the arts, poetry and art. And actually what's amazing is that we have Musashi's artworks, not all of them, but many of them exist, and they are absolute masterpieces. So this parallel between wielding the sword and wielding the brush, there are many, many volumes written about the parallels between the two. And his writings and his book are a great source of inspiration.
Do the swords have any relation to the mirror polished stainless steel art that you do?
In the sense that they were such incredible feats of engineering, and were also spiritual instruments as well. I mean, they influenced my thinking, I guess you could say. They were tremendously innovative. It's a terrible pun to say that they were cutting edge technology at the time, but they were cutting edge technology at the time. There was this technique that was used to fold the metal and keep folding it over and over and over again, which is what gives it this incredible strength and flexibility and made it not brittle. But there was just this extraordinary attention to detail and beauty and craftsmanship and honor and these values that are part of the code of Bushido, which is the way of the warrior, the way of the samurai, that are embedded into the way that they're built and constructed. And I think this idea that even the things that you don't see, maybe the same amount of attention to detail is going to be put into those. And that's a principle that I carry into my art. I, with my team, lavish a tremendous amount of time and detail and effort on all aspects of a work, even some of the things that you don't know about that you're not going to see. And I think that is important because the holistic piece stands on its own. I mean, another example that connects to that from Western art is that really inspires me are the sculptures at the top of the Parthenon frieze on the Acropolis. So those sculptures of the gods are now down at eye level and they're in the British Museum and they're amazing. The detail is extraordinary. The backs of Apollo and Dionysus. But it's extraordinary because the artists knew that those would never be seen at eye level. They were being seen. They were to be positioned so high up, way in the corner, up in this pediment of this building. You would only ever see the front. You would never see the back. But they finished every single detail perfectly because they knew that the gods would see their work.
That's incredible. Are there any other principles that you apply to your art or to yourself?
So many. So many things that Musashi says in the Book of the Five Rings. I mean, one thing he says is that, you know, you should observe reflectively with overall awareness of the large picture, as well as precise attention to small details. The large scale is easy to see. The small scale is hard to see. And that's something that's applicable to art, to science, to being a soldier, to being a warrior, I think. And he talks about, you know, how you need to look at things from different perspectives. There's so many beautiful metaphors in everything that he writes about. And actually, I really think that thinking like an artist, thinking like a scientist, thinking like a warrior, these really are the most important archetypes that have built civilization that everyone needs and that everyone can be a part of. Everyone can take some aspects of those things into their life. That's why, Justin, your podcast, I think, has such broad appeal. I mean, there's going to be people who are not in the military, who haven't flown, who are not part of aviation world, but that will be able to take so many different principles and ideas and sources of inspiration from what you're talking about, because all of these things are connected.
Well, thank you for that. Are there any lessons that you've learned over the years that you think would apply to, I know you talked about grit, which is super important. Is there anything else that you think that the audience would take away from what you do as an artist?
So lessons applicable from art to other fields, there's so many things, and there's so many things from other fields that we can import back into art. But I think that art can be a great way to reframe your perspective, to give you new perspectives on things. As I was saying earlier before, it's just a way of kicking open the door to all sorts of new possibilities that you hadn't been thinking of in your current frame of mind. I think creating an art or even just being exposed to great art can help you think about focusing on attention to detail and how important that is. Sometimes you can do something 99% and that last 1%, which is just that extra detail, is so critical and it's so hard to do, but it's so worth it. It makes such an impact on the final whole. I think that one of the things that I love about the artistic mindset also is this focus on creating versus consuming. I think the internet has given us many great things, but one of the things that's been unfortunate about us is that it has put us in a posture of being consumers over being creators, just sitting and passively almost taking in, like, just like sugar water, just watching, browsing, streaming, just passively accepting a lot of things versus in the offline world, you know, still today, it's easier to just pick things up and with different building blocks kind of just create. And so I think just always challenging yourself to really put yourself in more of an active, creative mode, an artistic, creative, active mode versus a passive consuming mode. The image that comes to my mind when I think about consumption taken to the nth degree are the round people in the movie WALL-E who have consumed so much that they can't even move anymore. So that's what we want to avoid. And then I think from the artistic perspective is this idea also of the benefits of visually consuming things slowly. So we live in a world where our attention is so scattered, it's so fractured. Everything is competing for our eyeballs and our visual attention. And we are jumping from thing to thing, looking at things in a very fractured way. And you can see this even when you go to the Museum of Modern Art in New York or any great museum. People are just going through, they're just taking cell phone pictures, picture, and then running through the museum like crazy, like they're on some kind of hellbent kind of checklist, when in actuality, you could sit in front of a great masterpiece as the way it was originally intended to be experienced, maybe for an hour, for 2 hours, come back, see it again, and really have the meaning and the impact of it unfold in your mind. An interesting study was done of people who went through a museum in such a way where the people who took all these pictures on their phone, they were compared with people who didn't have any cell phones. And the people who took all these pictures really quickly and went through the museum, they had very little visual recall of what they actually saw. So I think that that is true for a lot of us. We're going through the world mediated through our phones. We're just taking pictures of things, but we're not directly processing them firsthand. And I think, you know, one of the things that I loved about the artists from the Renaissance is that they had this focus on firsthand empirical knowledge. And I think there's a bit of laziness that we have today where we think we have an illusion that all the information in the world is just out there, that we could look it up at any time. But even with all the advances that have been made, if Leonardo was alive today and he wanted to know about the human kneecap, he wouldn't just go to the Wikipedia page. He would go find a kneecap and he would figure out what he personally thought about it. And I think that's really important because information is so processed and mediated. It's almost like processed meat by the time we get it. And we forget that. We just take something off the internet and think, oh, that's the real direct thing. No, there's really still today no substitute for direct experience, drawing your own conclusions, thinking for yourself. And then perhaps because you've done that work, you'll be able to draw some connections and make some leaps that no one else has made before.
There's so much good stuff there. The thought that comes to mind is Teddy Roosevelt's Man in the Arena quote of actually putting yourself out there. And to be an artist, it seems like you really have to put yourself out there to all the critics who couldn't do the art themselves, but to have them judge your art. Well, what projects are you working on right now that you're excited to debut soon?
Well, so we're always busy in the studio completing works for our collectors. And so right now we are finishing a piece for a collector in Latin America and simultaneously actually getting a work created for a collector in California. And we are doing some experimental things in VR that are involving artificial intelligence and some interesting collaborations there. And then I am working on a book which is called Creating for Immortality and is really inspired by the great creative forces in the Renaissance. And it's something that will, it's in the works. So it will be at least a year before it's, you know, completed. But that's a big project that I'm working on. And it's partly inspired by this idea that one of the fundamental things that I love about art is that it's this time capsule into the future. It's something that you embed your sacred values, what you hope, what you dream, what you learned, what you loved, and you put that in and you send it way off into the future. It's really extraordinary. I mean, when I go to the Vatican or the Louvre or even the Forbidden City, I get chills. It's really cosmic because there's people who are communicating with me for over a period of hundreds of years or thousands of years, but they're communicating to me in my present moment. And it's amazing. You know, art is the art, and like artifacts are the way that we remember the people that came before us. And the farther back in time that we go, the more reliant on those objects that we are. Like, how do we remember ancient Greece? How do we remember Rome? How do we remember ancient Egypt? It's through those artworks that are left behind. And up to this point, you know, art has been the best technology that we've created for long-term communication. It's been the best device, the best thing that we've ever come up with so far to have this kind of long-form communication.
Wow, that's incredible. I never thought of art that way. So where can people keep up and follow along with what you're doing?
My website is drue.net, drue.net. And I'm on Instagram at drukataoka, Drew Kataoka. That's the personal. And then the art studio's Instagram is Drew Kataoka Studios. And then on Facebook, there's a Drew Kataoka Studios Facebook page. And then I'm Drew Kataoka on Twitter. But my website is my home hub for everything. And I also have a newsletter that people can sign up for on the homepage, just like you, Justin.
Yeah, I'm working on that right now. Drew, well, thank you for coming on the show. Thank you for your time. And I look forward to talking with you again.
Thank you, Justin. I think the way of the warrior and the way of the artist have much in common. So it's been a rich discussion and it could go on for quite some time, but I think we covered a lot of ground.
Thanks for listening to the show. If you enjoyed it, you can help out by reviewing it on whatever platform you're listening to on. If you'd like to keep up with me, you can follow along on LinkedIn and Instagram at Justin Fighter Pilot. Today's episode was brought to you by Bremont, over-engineered watches for professionals. In the last few years, Bremont has taken over as the fighter pilot's watch. Their combination of precision, quality, and customer service is unmatched. You can see all their watches by going to Bremont.com. Today's episode was edited by Trevor Cabler. Again, thanks for listening. I'll talk to you in 2 weeks.